Good morning. Bill McCarthy was elected sheriff by the citizens of Polk County in November 2008. Prior to becoming sheriff, McCarthy served 2 years as chief deputy. Sheriff McCarthy began his 43-year law enforcement career in 1969 as a peace officer. He began his career with the Des Moines Police Department in 1970 and held numerous positions with the department. He served as the Des Moines police chief until his retirement in February 2006. Sheriff McCarthy has received numerous awards for his work with neighborhood and business groups and for his outstanding service to the citizens of Des Moines and youth groups throughout the community. He led the initiative for what is now known as community policing and was the driving force behind the City of Des Moines' Homeland Security Initiative, a plan now funded by the county and every municipal government within Polk County. His emphasis on establishing meaningful relationships with all minority groups and respecting their diversity is well known. And in March of this year, he was presented with the Mary Louise Smith Human Rights Award for his long-term commitment to raising the level of awareness and concern for human rights in the Des Moines area. He continues to be active in many civic and community organizations. Sheriff McCarthy earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in Criminal Justice and a Master of Public Administration degree from Drake University. He attended the Police Executive Research Forums and Harvard Senior Management Initiatives for Police and the FBI Law Enforcement Executive Development Program and is a certified polygraph examiner. As you can tell, he's not qualified for this job at all. Sheriff McCarthy was born and raised in Des Moines, and his wife, Linda, of 43 years, have 2 children and 3 grandchildren. He served in the United States Marine Corps and is a Vietnam veteran. For full disclosure, I'm an employee of Bill McCarthy's. I've been working at the jail for 6 years now, and so 4 of those for Sheriff McCarthy. On a personal note, I can say he truly cares about people's opinions and is a true consensus maker. He wants to hear everyone's opinion, whether he thinks it's a good one or not. It has been a pleasure to work for him, and I'm honored to introduce him today.
I'm not a public speaker, but I had called and asked Jonathan. I'm running for sheriff re-election, and I had asked him if I could come over and introduce myself to this group and make a pitch for your support and your vote. And Jonathan said, "Well, you can come this date or this date." And I looked at my calendar and I thought, "Well, this today sounds good," but as I hung up the phone, I realized it's too close to the election. You probably already voted most of them. But having said that, I just wanted to make a few comments. I want to thank Ken so much. He's our chief cook. There's not a better one around. And last night we got together a group of folks to honor our reserves, those that volunteer to augment our law enforcement component in the sheriff's office. And some of them up to 40 years of service. And Ken brought in chicken fried steak with gravy, beans, green beans with bacon all over the top. It was fabulous. And some kind of mashed potato like it was twice baked or something. And then on top of all that, he had all we can have in the jail, of course, is the plastic. But he had extra forks, and just like you'd set it out at the White House or something. It was really good. But thank you, Ken. And looking at this group, you always kind of want to tell a joke, and I hope you haven't heard it. But looking at this group, it looks like it might be appropriate in terms of age. And that's a friend of mine. Huh?
An old joke.
Yeah. A friend of mine was about to retire, and so he wanted to go line up his Social Security. And he got in line over there, and first time in, if you've done this, you understand what I'm saying, he didn't have the right paperwork after standing in line for about 45 minutes. So he had to go back and gather it up, and he came back again the next day, and he stands in line. Well, it just so happens the line he's standing in is some gal that's just got into it with her boss there in the Social Security office, and she's going to screw with everybody that comes up. And so she looks at his paperwork, and he's got everything he should have, by the way. But she looks at it, and she says, well, on the birth certificate, she says, this stamp isn't raised high enough. I can't feel it with my finger, and you're going to have to back and do better than that. Have somebody notarize it or something. And he, you know, of course, he didn't want to hear that. And he says, I can't do that. He says, I've been here 2 days. I'm tired. This is a real hassle. Is there anything you can do? And she says, well, I don't know. I guess maybe I want to help people, and maybe I can help you out. And she said, I used to be a nurse. I don't know if you knew that or not. And of course, he thought to himself, well, how in the hell would I know that? But anyway, she said, well, give me your hand. And so he reached out his hand. She said, now, when you get in your middle 60s, you have those little patica sun marks. And she said, yeah, you've got those. And he, oh, yeah, that's good. I do. I've got them. And she said, well, turn your head. And because usually when you hit about 65, there's a little bit of skin that loosens up in back of the ear. So she moved his ear and what have you. And she said, yeah, I believe you're 65. I'll go ahead and help you out here. Don't tell my boss, but I'll help you out. So she went ahead and accepted the paperwork. So he was really feeling good about himself, and he went home and he told his wife all about this, and she wasn't happy about him retiring anyway. They'd had some issues. And she said, listen, you silly old coot, why don't you just drop your pants and maybe we could have got disability too. So, before I talk about the sheriff's office, I wanted to mention this to specifically Jonathan, that I, you know, you go in front of a lot of groups and you answer questions and what have you about what you've done and what you want to do and all this kind of stuff. Well, I had the honor and privilege of presenting myself to the Iowa Bystander. And I don't know if you're familiar with that publication, but it's been around for a long, long time. And in this case, the two people that interviewed me was kind of an odd couple. It was the president of the school board, Dick Murphy, and Jonathan Narcissus. And side by side, sitting there, and they're going to interview me. And Jonathan started out by saying, he says, we want to find out about you. We don't want to hear about your opponent. So accept this premise that your opponent is a dirty, rotten, no good bum, and you don't have to talk about him. And you know, I got my mind just started wandering. I was really feeling good about thinking about all those things. And finally, Jonathan says, "Hey, back to the interview." but anyway, the only thing I want to mention about my opponent is the fact that I haven't been able to outwork him in terms of the election effort. He goes 100 miles an hour, but he's considerably younger than I am, and I give him all kinds of credit for that initiative and work. I don't believe he's qualified. He's not invested anything in himself, and he's not moved up the ranks sufficiently within a law enforcement organization that he'd be readily accepted amongst his peers, other chiefs of police or sheriffs. But in time, I think he will make that bill. He is a pretty sharp kid. Having said that, I just wanted to talk about the sheriff's office because it's one that usually isn't involved in most people's lives. And I want to tell you how it is and what a sheriff's office actually does, at least in Polk County. First off, the sheriff has a larger variety of things that he or she is responsible for, as opposed to simply being chief of police, where the focus is of the community. In the sheriff's office, we have a civil division, and we serve papers for the clerk of court's office. And we serve, on average, about 100,000 papers a year for that office, and that includes the foreclosures and any kind of action that Jonathan or his peers would file with the court. If there is a service, likely we're going to be the ones that serve that paper. That includes the domestic abuse orders, or if a judge wants to take a gun or something from somebody. Some of them are dangerous, so we use the deputies to do that. And some are ones we can just simply mail to people and get a computerized signature. But it's a we kind of use that, and others do as well, to kind of measure the financial situation in the community in terms of the homes that are lost and the foreclosures and things of that nature. But that's a very busy entity. The sheriff's office makes about $1 million in return for providing those services, which offset some of the cost to provide those deputies. We also handle court security, which is a pretty good task. If you've ever been around the judges, and I know I'm being taped, so I got to be careful how I say this, but each one of them is the boss. There is, I mean, it's not like you can go to the chief judge and say, "Judge, is there any way we can get this accomplished?" He likely has the authority, but each one of them have their own kingdom. So you got to kind of be nice to all of them. And we learn after a period of time how to work around most of that, and we get along with them. For the most part, our judges here in Polk County are extremely fine, hardworking individuals. And I, all kidding aside, I really mean that. But we have that responsibility. And then we transport prisoners. And we don't just transport them from the jail to the courthouse. We transport them to other places, particularly those locations that can provide assistance for drug and alcohol problems and for mental health issues. And so that's we're always transporting a certain population 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we've got quite a few vans and the capability to do that. We also have a police department, if you will, that where we provide services for the unincorporated parts of Polk County. Now, in Polk County, we also serve a couple communities that are incorporated, and we do that on a contract basis, and one is Bondurant and the other is Grimes. But we have, in unincorporated Polk County, we serve a population of about 41,000 people. And for comparison purposes, I like to compare it to the city of Urbandale, because Urbandale has a population of about 41,000 people. They field 4 or 5 officers a shift, and then they have an investigative capability and the kind of things you'd expect out of a police department. Well, we have the same thing. We field 4 officers because we have 4 territories in the unincorporated areas. The areas we patrol are quite a bit larger than what you'd find in a municipality, but it's rural. It's a rural environment, and those folks, for the most part, think a little bit differently than we do in the city. In the city, if somebody takes over 3 minutes to get there on an emergency call, I'm going to get a call the next day. How come that happened? In the county and in the rural areas of the state, people don't think that way. They don't have that same expectation, although our response times in northern Polk County are very good. We have an investigative capability, and you know, a detective who can follow up on a case, be it an auto theft case or a homicide or a rape or something like that. And we have a clearance rate that either exceeds or is as good as anything nationally. So I'm pretty pleased with that. And then we have the jail. And the jail, all those other responsibilities are equally important, but the jail is a full-time occupation. On average, we have about 1,000 prisoners there every single day of the week. And just if you think about the food that gets prepared for those folks, 3 meals a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and prepared in a way that it's presentable and edible and it meets their needs. Now remember, when I say that, I'm not being soft on crime, which I've been accused of, but let's remember the people in our jail, for the most part, have not been convicted of the crime they're in that jail for. There's a difference between a jail and a penitentiary, and if there is a difference and we recognize it, then we ought to treat them like human beings, and we ought to do that anyway, just simply because they are. And we catch them at that moment in time when something bad has happened. But we feed them, and we feed them decently. I've actually had folks come into us and say, "We represent a company that feeds jails and prisons around the United States. And by gosh, we can save money for you. We can save this amount of money." And I say, "Okay, well, show me what your menu would be." And I had one individual take a can of Coke out of his briefcase and laid it on the table, and he said, "Now that will count for this much caloric intake, so you can take away this many beans or this much meat." And I thought to myself, "My God, what are we talking about here?" But that's what gets sold to the politicians, and then pretty soon there's a demand for us to save money. I want to resist that, and I want to make sure we keep people like Ken on staff, and that we treat people like they should be treated. Secondly, we've never had a problem in the jail because we treat them properly. In fact, one of the tenets our jail is based on, and it's called a direct supervision jail, which means if you think of the traditional mode where you have a hallway and you have cells and you lock two people up in each cell, ours is where you have a big room and you put 64 people in the room, and you put one guard in with the 64 people, and then the guard kind of regulates what happens in that room. And we know there's no way the guard could defend himself if the room went bad. But the people that do this tell me day in and day out that they prefer it over the traditional model. Because they say to these folks in that cell, "Look, I didn't put you in here, but you're in here, and you're not going to get out until you get out under some kind of a process. But if you act like an adult and you're respectful, we'll treat you like an adult and we'll treat you with respect." And that message usually gets through. Would you think that? This is one of our detention officers, and I've been impressed by that. I was a little uncomfortable when I came over and saw how it actually operated, but it really works. Now, when you get a prisoner occasionally that kind of loses it and goes after the guard, we don't ever rely on the ability of the prisoners to help that guard, but invariably that's what happens because they don't want to have their lives disrupted. They don't want to be put in different pods, and they don't want to have their friendships broken up and they're what they're accustomed to or used to. So it's it's like a house of cards, but it holds together. Another tenet that a direct supervision jail is built on is our ability to analyze who you are when you come into the jail. And we look at a lot of things to make that determination, and it may take us 4 hours to make that judgment. It may take us a day and a half to make that judgment. And we put you in a very concentrated area where we can protect you and keep an eye on you until we can make that judgment. But the secret of our situation is we have 19 areas we can put you in. If we can put you with like-minded people, I'm not talking about the crime, but like-minded people, everything runs smooth. If we put you in the wrong pod, chances are bad things are going to happen. And one of the detention officers explained it to me this way, that if you can put the wolves with the wolves and the sheep with the sheep, everything works perfect. If you mix it up, you got a problem. And but the jail itself functions really well, and I'm so very proud of it, and I'm proud of the way we treat the people that are in there, and I'm proud of the fact that we use prisoners to help us prepare the food and do the laundry and do some other things, and then they in return get time off of their you know, let's say the judge gives them 30 days and they have to spend that with us, they get time off of that. And then they don't have to pay us what otherwise would be a room and board fee. I think it's about $50 a day. I've been thinking of something kind of crazy, and it's a legitimate job. It's a full-time job, and I really enjoy it. I was not ready to go be a greeter at Walmart, so this is something that will keep me occupied. And if reelected, I think I do them a good job, and I'll continue to do a good job. But if there's any questions about what we do or anything on the election, I'd be happy to speak to any of that. Yes, sir.
It's nice to see a politician running for office who doesn't spend a lot of time bummer having his
opponent. I have not said a negative word about him the whole time. Thank you, Dan.
The guy running against the sheriff is pretty much a part of the Tea Party. The sheriff... People drawn to law enforcement a lot of times, and I know this because I was in law enforcement, a lot of them tend to be pretty right-wing people who want to carry a club around and beat on people. That's in my interest because I'm a lawyer and I file civil rights cases. So if this guy that's running against Sheriff McCarthy gets elected, I'm going to be a very busy person. But none of the rest of us are going to be happy, because it's not the kind of sheriff we've had in this county for a long time. And Sheriff McCarthy is the best of the sheriffs we've had in this county for a long time. And those of you, I've already voted for him, but those of you who haven't voted for him, this is something you ought to look for on the ballot and vote for Sheriff McCarthy. Because if this other guy gets elected, the kind of environment that the sheriff talks about at the jail is not going to exist anymore. And some real brutality is going to be unleashed on the people in the jail.
Well, thank you, Dan. I didn't want to say anything to pander to any group or anybody, but I am particularly proud of something in my past that I think was ahead of the curve. And it wasn't just me, it was Bill Mulder. He was chief of police in Des Moines for 18 years. He came to us from Kansas City, and we just hated the idea that we were going to hire an outsider, and fought and kicked and worked politically to try to block it. It turned out he was not only a breath of fresh air, but he was probably the best chief we ever had. But in 1988, we had a very vicious assault by a couple young men that thought they were skinheads, and it occurred over on the west side, over not too far from where G&L clothing is. And as a result of that, one of the young men that was assaulted was a Drake student. And there was a young lady that came to us, and I cannot remember her name now, but a junior, but she was, I mean, she just had a mastery of what was going on and how to deal with people. And she asked us if she wanted to meet with the chief and the chief of detectives. That was me at the time. Chief detectives, and she wanted to know if we would form a liaison with the LGBT community, and that she was president of it, Drake, and we thought about it and talked about it and told her we'd get back with her, and Mulder, pretty progressive guy, he left it up to me, and I thought, well, if we do this thing internally, it's going to get rejected, and we'll have a lot of issues to deal with. And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And I was telling Ken that my mother's youngest brother was a fellow that was Liberace's personal secretary, and was somebody that she loved dearly, and we all loved. He was a handsome guy, and lived out in San Francisco with Liberace, and he was kind of the star in our family, and when he came to town, it was a big deal, and so forth and so on. But I thought about him, and I know this is going to sound crazy, but I knew the humanity he had and the love he had for us, and it made me stop and think that the issues that I grew up with, we've got to wrestle with, apparently, on both sides. So I went to Mulder and I said, yes, we'll do that. I picked a sergeant by the name of Bob Irvin, and I thought that there'd be a lot. We didn't have any resistance in the Des Moines Police Department to it. If there was, nothing was spoken out loud. And at that time, it reassured at least that group of people at Drake that she was in charge of, that they had a legitimate right to the protections and access to the people that operate certain powers within government. And it just worked out beautifully. And before she left Des Moines, she came on her own, came back to the department. By then, Mulder was gone, and I was the chief, but she gave me a big hug. And I just think it was just something we all had to work through. Occurred in 88. Maybe it was a little bit ahead of the curve, maybe it wasn't, but I was real proud of that. Having said that, I'm done, Jonathan, and I thank you all very, very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Other questions? Back here.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
How do you go about doing
No, it's increased dramatically. That's what I've been told since I've been here, having nothing to do with me being here. And a lot of that is done automatically, too. And we're trying to enter into the world where, use the deputies for those where you might have some issues, and then begin to shift into a mode where we can process these things through the mail. And some companies have said they don't want anything to do with that. Others have said they welcome it because then they don't have to calculate the mileage for us and allow us to calculate it and then them pay for it and the uncertainty of when it gets delivered and that kind of stuff. So we're just kind of working through all that now. And I'm not sure, if you ask me to break that $100,000 down, I'm not sure at what level what all they're talking about, whether they're counting duplicate pages or what, but that's what I'm told is the service.
Others? There's one.
I was talking yesterday. I'm kind of new to the point. I was talking yesterday to Paul Turner, who is the lead organizer for AMOS, and he was telling me about some of their activities to start to support young black men who are being prosecuted largely for nonviolent crimes. And I know you're not running for district attorney, but I'd appreciate if you could just reflect on racial disparities in detention and prosecutions and how you work with the district attorney's office and anything that you have to say about that.
Well, we in our jail, and I think that's pretty symptomatic of reflective of Iowa, now, maybe not other states, but of Iowa, because we have apparently one of the highest disproportionate rates. And also, I spent two full years on a disproportionate overrepresentation committee that Governor Bill Vilsack put together, and there were individuals from all over the state on that committee, and we have the report's on file, and we came up with 23 recommendations, none of which have been followed by anybody. But the fact of the matter is, there is a disproportionate number. Now, if you take our jail and roughly 57 out of 100 people in our jail are white, then there's a population of about 21 or 22 that's black, and then the rest are made up of Hispanic, Native American, Oriental, and other. And so, you know, obviously the majority is white, or claim the white affiliation. But when you look at the percentages back in the population, that's where the disproportionate numbers come from. And I think you got to be careful when you go down this path, because I always see the victim out there. That's what police see most. They eventually see the suspect, but mostly they see the victims, and they tend to empathize very dramatically with the victims over a period of time. And so I think you got to look at the behavior, and you also have to hold people accountable, because without bottom lines, the system don't work. It just don't work. And I can tell you it's not a funny story, but it's one where in 1976, when they came out with the Juvenile Justice Prevention Act, which kind of put everybody upside down as the states interpreted it, it changed everything, and you couldn't lock kids up, and we worked through the interpretations of that and so forth and so on. So knowing that we had young men out there stronger and bigger than their single mom, and feeling all kinds of hormones, and nobody's going to tell them what to do, could knock any police officer on their ass for the most part, you have to be able to do something with that population. And so we decided, okay, if the court says we can't lock them up for those crimes that otherwise wouldn't be a crime for an adult, such as truancy or the inability to listen to folks or curfew violations or things like that, you could bring them down. We used an old courtroom in the police building, thinking that would be less offensive to the court, you know, if they should challenge it. So it's kind of cynical, but we used the old courtroom. And we'd take the kid and we'd put him in there, and that got him off the street and away from whatever the fight or the problem was, to give them a chance to cool down. Secondly, We made a parent come down and get him, or a relative come down and get him. And then we put a detective in the door, and he sat with a chair in the doorway. We didn't lock the door because the law said you couldn't do that. But they weren't going to walk by the detective either. And so long and short of it is, we'd get a hold of parents. Some didn't have parents. But for those that did, the when the dad come down, you know, the detectives would tell these stories. The father would come up and he'd want to know what happened. Why was this kid arrested? How come the other people weren't arrested? What my kid did, you know, makes sense to me. And this is a kid we were going to see time and time and time again. And we did. And for those parents that come down and get their kid, and somewhere out in the hallway you'd hear, you likely would never see that kid again. So it's a roundabout way to say it's more complicated in the answer than the question. And we don't do anybody any service if to accomplish the goal, we stop counting the crime. On the other hand, let's be reasonable where we apply the law, which is in the courtrooms and the legislature. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it's kind of a long way to get to that.
Other questions? Right here.
There are a number of people in Polk County with mental illness that find it easier to get into jail. Can you talk about what you and others are doing about that?
Well, I think it's an issue that is just now kind of rising to the surface. To the surface and beginning to get the attention it should get, because these folks, the type that you described, should not be in jail. That's not an appropriate place. It may be that you need the capabilities of law enforcement and the jail to subdue them or keep them from hurting somebody or themselves. But once having said that, they need to be someplace else where they can get the medication and the treatment. Now, we've done little things in the jail. The first thing is we're now keeping stats and have for a year or so on these folks. We ask them, do you take any medication for any mental illness? Do you have any issues that you know about? And then we try to run those things down to verify them. We also ask them for their medication. Used to be we'd take it from them, and then our people would prescribe whatever they felt would get them by. Now we let them keep that medication just simply with the approval of a pharmacist's oversight, so that if they're doing good on it, and usually when they get in trouble, it's because they're not taking their medication. The other thing we do, so we keep them consistent, when we release them, we give them a certain amount of medication and try to set up a situation where they have to take it to help make that transition. And then the system just gets a little bit better, put pressure on some of the state institutions not to close and to leave those services open for evaluation purposes and to provide those treatments. And slowly, as the legislature works through this reorganization, which they took the first major step last year, I think we'll begin to see a more enlightened approach. We have 28 nurses on staff. We have a doctor, a psychiatrist, a pharmacist, and a dentist. And you might say, why do we do that? Well, come on now. We probably minister, if you will, to the lowest level on the rung. We have people that come in with teeth falling out of their head and no place else to go and lots of issues and lots of health problems. And they are people, and we have to have that staff. Now, if we were to take those same folks to the hospitals and the clinics, remember what that would cost. It would be prohibited for the county. In fact, when I visited a jail in Florida, I walked in. I was shocked to see that they had two dialysis machines, and they were providing that right in the jail. So we have an infirmary. We have six special reversible air cells where we can put somebody that has a highly contagious problem. And we have a place where after you're treated in the hospital, we can bring you back and you can recoup. But we have a full medical contingent in the jail. And I mean, our clinic looks like anybody's clinic. And It saves us literally millions of dollars. And yes, we have those people on staff.
Others? That'll probably do it then.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, Sheriff McCarthy may not like public speaking, but he's obviously very good at it. And he's a remarkably enlightened public servant and has been for a long time and done outstanding work. And I think he is a shining example of just how professional, how experienced, and how humane a person in law enforcement can be. I think he epitomizes that.